Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's recent call to improve cybersecurity, which he is expected to expand upon in next week's State of the Union address. Peter Singer, a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation, whose latest book is Cybersecurity and Cyber War: What Everyone Needs to Know, joins us to discuss the gap between military capabilities and civilian defenses made clear by the Sony hack, as well as the recurring breaches of large corporations like Target that expose millions of consumers to cyber theft, and the recent rash of cyber attacks on CENTCOM's Twitter account and threats by Anonymous to hack jihadi websites. Then we'll examine the hypocrisy of going to war against the so-called Islamic State because of their brutal beheadings of journalists and now being allied with Saudi Arabia against ISIL, while the ruling feudal Saudi royal family carried out 82 beheadings in 2014 alone. Sarah Whitson, the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division, joins us to discuss Saudi Arabia's policies of intolerance and extremism and the recent public flogging of Raif Badawi, the liberal blogger who was sentenced to 1,000 lashes and 10 years in jail for, quote, going beyond the realm of obedience, meaning deviating from absolute fealty to the king. We will also discuss Sarah's article at CNN, Saudi Bloggers Flogging Should Outrage the World. Then finally, we will speak with Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly and a former special assistant and chief speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, about his article at The Washington Monthly, Why a Second Progressive Era is Emerging and How Not to Blow It. At a time when Republicans control both the Senate and the House and are moving aggressively to weaken the government and government programs that serve the American people, we will look into how a counter-revolution to this government now in power of the oligarchy, for the oligarchy, and by their servants, might emerge and who might lead it. And joining us now is Peter Singer, a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of several books, including Corporate Warriors, The Rise of the Privatized Military Industry, Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflicts in the 21st Century, and his latest co-authored with Alan Friedman, Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Singer.
Thanks for having me.
And a few days ago, the president made a speech on and unveiling new cybersecurity measures. And it seems to me that following the Sony hack, it became quite apparent that there's a huge gap between military capabilities and civilian defenses. Would you agree with that?
Yes, but not as illustrated by the Sony hack. So there's definitely a difference between the capabilities of, say, the NSA, as we've seen disclosed by Edward Snowden's leaks, versus the capabilities of most private companies to defend themselves. But where I'm differing with you is the Sony hack, for all the attention, for all the damage it did, the tools that were used were not ones that were developed special by the North Koreans. For a large part, they were things that were available off cyber black markets. So, you know, this wasn't the idea of them deploying something new like a Stuxnet, a new digital weapon. One cybersecurity analyst described it as they were using the equivalent of like a pipe bomb. It was effective, but, you know, let's not give them credit for something that didn't play out there. It was more a problem of Sony really doing a repeatedly poor job of paying attention to its own cybersecurity.
And would that explain, well, if you use that as a yardstick, would that mean, in fact, that in Sony's defense, they said that 90% of American corporations couldn't have defended themselves against the type of attack that they got from North Korea, albeit North Korea being, you know, way down on the list of cyber capabilities compared to the leading cyber warfare countries, which are the US, the UK, Israel, China, and Russia. So Sony's not alone, I take it, in terms of civilian defenses for American corporations.
No, and let's put it this way. 97% of Fortune 500 companies admitted that they've been hacked at some point. The other 3% have been, too. They're just not willing to admit it. The key is not whether you've been breached, but what happens next. That is, no one should expect 100% security. It's instead resilience. How do you power through the attacks? How do you get back up quickly when you've been knocked down? And that's really the difference between what played out in, say, the Sony episode and other cases. You know, so the hackers got in, but then it seemed they had pretty much free and unfettered access to anything and everything from financial information to, you know, embarrassing emails. It took a lot of cybersecurity folks by surprise how easy that was. Or another example is clearly a massive amount of information was being gathered and pulled out of that network. Internal monitoring is a common practice to let you know about these things and, hey, something funny is going on right now. That didn't seem to be playing out there. There's a lot of basic how-tos that, you know, companies can do to defend themselves. We shouldn't think that this is something that, that can't be done. But again, there's a difference between the advanced levels of capabilities where, you know, when we're talking about military side, whether it's the NSA or things that Russia or China have used versus the run-of-the-mill stuff. It's actually a good parallel to the story that's been in the news more recently, the hack of CENTCOM's Twitter feed. You know, people go, wow, this is the U.S. military. How could it be hacked by, you know, a couple people that seem to be posing as ISIS when they have this $700 billion budget? Well, the reality is it was their Twitter account. It's not like they got into the super secret advanced networks. And so we need to distinguish between these things out there.
So, Peter Singer, my understanding, though, in terms of the Sony hack was that, I mean, a better security that the military have and the NSA have, et cetera, would have detected the intrusion immediately, and that the fact that the intrusion happened and wasn't detected, and then the hackers were able to sort of lurk in Sony's system for something like 6 months, I believe, is pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
We want to stay out of blame the victim mode when we're in this space. So, and we also, this is a incident where not all the details are known, including not just by the people involved in the investigation, but there are things that we know. We know, for example, this is a company that has been repeatedly hacked, at least going back to 2005, and yet didn't have a heightened level of cybersecurity awareness, might we say, among its employees, in particular among senior executives, it seems. There were certain warning signals that would have popped, not just in sophisticated military operations, but in companies just doing good regular basic cybersecurity protocols, like that example of are there people inside your network and are they extracting massive amounts of information? These are some of the warning bells that go off. Then the ability to have a plan ready to go for how you're going to deal with a breach, including the PR strategy side of things, which is hugely important. And this is not just something that Sony's experienced. It's been the difference between hacks that we don't talk about and ones like, say, the Target one that hurt that company severely. It wasn't just how they handled the technology side. It was how they handled the public affairs side of things. So there's a lot of different lessons to pull from it. But I think, you know, what you're getting at, Ian, is when we look at the space of actors out there, the threats, they range from high-end, sophisticated, well-funded, state government-linked operations to proxy groups that may be acting on behalf of state governments. And we've seen that in everything from some of the China hacks to the Russian hits in Ukraine. And maybe this was one of the things that played out with this hack on Sony or not. It's still being debated as to North Korea or North Korean proxies, or maybe it was someone else. But you have this proxy groups. And then you have the third category, which is cybercrime. And then you have the fourth category, which is groups that are after something else, be it political protests or attention, hacktivism of some sort. And then there's people that are just in it for, frankly, fun, just to see if they can do it. And so there's this wide set of actors with a wide set of skill sets, but they all can carry out some kind of action.
And in terms of going back to the president's announcements on Tuesday and offering measures to beef up cybersecurity in the domestic arena, just in terms of of some of the definitions that the White House has put forth recently. For example, with the Sony hack, they called it cyber vandalism. And it would seem to me that that might well have been a deliberately invented term to lower the threshold from cyber war. Do we live in a world in which the capabilities, the military capabilities of China, Russia, Israel, the US and the UK are much, much greater perhaps than we know, and they're probably growing, and that there's a kind of mutually assured destruction as there was in the Cold War, that nobody wants to pull the trigger?
We live in a world where militaries are all active in this space, or at least the advanced militaries of the world. Another way of putting it is at least 100 governments around the world, from the U.S. to Russia to Venezuela, have created some kind of military unit designed to fight and win wars in cyberspace. So they've created organizations like Cyber Command in the U.S., or North Korea has the what's been known as Unit 121, units designed to fight and win wars in these space. And their operations that they carry out range from protecting their own military networks. Militaries now depend on computers and computer communications, to trying to get into adversaries' networks. And then you have the question of, what are you going to do when you're in there? Are you going to steal secrets from them, which is something that, I mean, frankly, is playing out right now. All these different organizations, whether it's the American one or the Chinese one or the Israeli one, are all trying to get into their adversaries' networks and monitor what's happening on there. We really wouldn't call that war, but it's part of war or conflict. The real key, you know, we may be talking about something new and technologic, but I'm a traditionalist in this. To me, war has to involve the same kind of things that it's always involved. It's got to be violence and linked to politics in some way, shape, or form. And so this example of the Sony hack, I think it was right to call it vandalism. It wasn't to the level of war. It was painful for Sony, but no one died. Similarly, when people say, oh, it was an act of cyber terrorism, again, I'm a traditionalist. No one was killed. No one was even physically harmed. The reputation of certain Hollywood studio executives was harmed, but this was not 9/11, nor was it a cyber 9/11. So, you know, again, it doesn't mean it was not meaningful, but part of our growing up and better dealing with this space is distinguishing between the different kind of actions and activities that are taking place. Now, that said, the measures that you might put into place to defend against it, to prevent these bad things, are good, whether you're talking about the threat is cyber conflict, cyber theft, espionage, cyber terrorism, vandalism, whatever. So, for example, the president has proposed we do better at information sharing about threats. There are certain controversial elements around liability questions, but what I'm getting at there is that you could see how these might be helpful, whether you're worried about a real cyber war attack in the event of a war, or you're worried about someone stealing information from you or vandalizing your websites. It's a lot like how in public health, there's certain basic measures that are good whether you're scared about bird flu or just the regular old flu. But to get to the other part of your question, the mutual assured destruction part of it, because you got so many different actors out there with so many different kinds of capabilities, it's not like the Cold War where there were just two sides and it was very clear what they were, what their risks were, and if they acted, the actions were evident. That is, if you carried out a nuclear attack on Russia or vice versa, it was clear something was happening. That's what you were deterring. That was the mad scenario. With cyber, there's many other actors, and it's also never so self-evident that something has happened and who did it.
So, Peter Singer, how would you then characterize the hack on CENTCOM by ISIS or somebody pretending to be ISIS and the threat from Anonymous to go after those that killed the journalists at Charlie Hebdo?
So the hack of CENTCOM's Twitter feed. Again, to be clear, they didn't get into any military communications networks used to move classified information or not even classified information. They got into a civilian network. They got into Twitter that, you know, I'm on and you're on and, you know, millions of other people are on, that the military was using as its, in effect, megaphone to talk, to do public affairs. The group that did it appears not to be ISIS, in large part because of the fact that they called themselves ISIS. ISIS is an acronym for what we call it. The group itself doesn't use that acronym. They also changed it to say, I love you, ISIS. And, you know, as a joke, ISIS is not a group that uses the verb love all that much. But so they got in, and then they posted various things that, for the most part, some of it posed as if it was classified information, and it turns out it wasn't. It was things you could have found on the internet. And other was, you know, silly stuff. There was one of the first things they posted was a picture of a goat. So on one hand, we could say, you know, it wasn't all that consequential. It was really just embarrassing to the military. That said, that still can be important because it fits within this overall kind of narrative of the U.S. military, the big guy, being brought back down by the little guy. The U.S. military that spent, you know, over $1.2 billion a day. It spent over $1.2 billion overall fighting ISIS. It's around $8 million a day. And yet can't even keep control of its own Twitter feed. So it's kind of an embarrassing thing, and that has significance in propaganda, particularly for non-state groups like ISIS that are, you know, always looking for attention, they're looking for recruits. It was a useful thing to them, even if they weren't the ones behind it. Now, in turn, then we've seen other groups like Anonymous, which is a more decentralized hacktivist group, announce that it's going to go after various things, and in this case, particularly some of the people, maybe the groups behind some of these killings. And it's a good illustration of the changes in the world we're in, where the actors that matter are not just the big state governments with the multi-billion-dollar budgets, but also their non-state groups. And even in Anonymous's case, it's basically an online collective. And that's a very powerful illustration of the changes of 21st century politics right now.
Well, we know, Peter Singer, that Russia has used cyber warfare against Estonia and other Baltic countries. My understanding is that the Russian FSB were very early in organizing the digital underground and using these people as false flag operatives. Is that your understanding?
They've long shown an interest in this space of, and you can frame it a lot of different ways. You know, this is more than just cyber warfare, cyber conflict, or espionage. It also links to what we might call information operations. So they've long held interest in this. One of the ways that it's playing out, though, is not just through their direct action by, that is, their formal state apparatus. You know, so FSB, you know, its equivalents would be akin to the CIA or NSA, but also through the use of proxies. And in the Russian case, they have a fairly vibrant, shall we say, organized crime, in particular cyber criminal network. And so one of the things that analysts believe has played out in some of these attacks is the use of this broader non-state resource, the being deployed for state purposes. If you think about it, it's a little bit like the parallel of during World War II, the U.S. government went to the mafia and said, all right, you're going to help us. We're going to, you know, they kind of struck a tacit deal where the mafia helped them with everything from gathering intelligence on what was happening in Italy at the time to they helped monitor the harbors in the U.S. for Nazi spies. So it was a criminal group, but the government was working with them, deploying them for them. And there's a belief that there's a little bit of that playing out right now when we talk about some of the operations that Russia has done, that the government may be not just merely turning a blind eye to some of the criminal side, but deploying it on its behalf, you know, essentially saying this is what good patriotic people are going to do now. And part of the indicator of that is not just the technical side, but also how they've seen some of these attacks happen timed very well and in cohesion with things that Russian linked to politics or what Russian troops or troops that they were supporting. And so, you know, they went, huh, these cyber criminals were doing this, but then on this date at this time, all of this happened, and it just happened to work perfectly with, you know, something that was going on in Crimea or Ukraine. So it's just fascinating, and it makes it very hard to deal with because when you've got proxies, you can say, well, that wasn't us, that was these non-state actors, and that's where there's a link between kind of the challenge of this, as we've seen in Russia, to a lot of the hacks coming from China when it comes to intellectual property theft. A lot of it fits in the same pattern of proxies where it's not directly the Chinese government, but it's happening to the benefit of Chinese government or business.
Well, there was a very powerful PBS frontline on Tuesday, Peter Singer, on Putin and Putin's kleptocracy, and it made it very clear that Russia is a criminal state run by organized criminals headed by Vladimir Putin. So it's a little surprise that there would be this cross-pollination, if you will, between cyber criminals and state cyber warfare operatives.
But I mean, that's we can go back and forth on that, but, you know, the bottom line is, would you be surprised that Putin is not following by the established rules of the game and or bending them to his own advantage? Of course not. That's actually, you know, that's his game, and that applies here in the cyber realm as well. But let's be utterly clear. The same, you know, could be said of some of the things that we've pulled off in our operations. And there's a certain guy hiding out in Russia right now who, you know, dumped literally not just hundreds, not just thousands, but millions of data points on that named Edward Snowden. And that's also a good illustration of the prior part of our conversation where we were talking about the risk that organizations have to hacking and kind of the claim of, oh my goodness, you know, that Sony and others have made of, you know, I couldn't have dealt with this advanced threat. Only governments could deal with this advanced threat. Well, the simple measure of monitoring your own networks for huge dumps of information, that's something Sony should have been doing, and it would have helped them. But, oh, by the way, it was something that was supposed to be happening at the NSA, but hadn't yet made its way across the bureaucracy to the office in Hawaii where Edward Snowden was. If they had had that into place, we wouldn't have heard of him. He would have been caught before everything played out. So, again, big organizations, big, well-funded, sophisticated organizations sometimes fail in their very simple security procedures.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Peter Singer.
Thanks very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Singer, who's a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of several books, including Corporate Warriors, The Rise of the Privatized Military Industry, Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century, and his latest co-authored with Alan Friedman, Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into Saudi Arabia's policies of intolerance and extremism.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sarah Whitson, who's Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division, where she oversees 19 countries with staff located in 10 countries. She has led dozens of advocacy and investigative missions throughout the region, focusing on issues of armed conflict, accountability, legal reform, migrant workers, and political rights. She has published widely on human rights issues in the Middle East in international and regional media, including the New York Times, Foreign Policy, the Los Angeles Times, and CNN, where she has an article, Saudi Bloggers' Flogging Should Outrage the World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Whitson.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks, Sarah. And I must say the fate of Raif Badawi, a 31-year-old Saudi blogger who was sentenced to 1,000 lashes, and he received 50 lashes. He was flogged in a public square in front of a mosque, and he's been told he'll receive another 50 lashes on Friday. I take it this will happen until he gets through the 1,000 lashes?
That is what the Saudi authorities have planned for him.
So you're concerned that there's not enough outrage around the world. And also, I think when ISIS first broke on the international scene and beheaded some journalists, I talked to a number of Middle East specialists who made that connection, that saying, how come we are so outraged about the beheading of hostages by the so-called Islamic State when it's perfectly routine in Saudi Arabia? So why do the Saudis get a free pass?
Well, that's a good question, and it's also a good question as to why they are part of a coalition to defeat ISIS when one of the ostensible purposes of defeating ISIS is because we are revolted at their beheadings.
And in Saudi Arabia, beheadings are quite routine, are they not?
Beheadings are in fact the routine way that people are executed. And of course, Saudi is a world leader in executions and routinely executes people for nonviolent offenses such as drug trafficking, but also absurd offenses, and I don't even know if I should call it an offense, but things like sorcery.
So in August alone, Saudi Arabia beheaded at least 26 people, and there were 82 executions in 2014, making Saudi Arabia the world leader in capital punishment. Again, you know, one is left puzzled as to why it is that there's not more focus on the roots of Islamic extremism if you have a country that practices this kind of behavior.
I think that's absolutely right, and it's just hard to justify the moral outrage that American policymakers are expressing when it comes to ISIS beheading people or ISIS violently attacking journalists in France, when they have very little to say about their erstwhile staunch ally, Saudi Arabia, doing these things as a matter of state practice. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, perhaps it has something to do with oil, do you think?
Well, I think oil is a part of it. The other is the reality that they believe they need some kind of an alliance with the Saudi government, regardless of its rights record, for some ill-conceived notion of stability in the region.
Well, this blogger, whose offense was to start a liberal blog and to engage in a discussion about political ideas and perhaps even touching on religious ideas, and of course he's in a country that's a theocracy, but it's not entirely a theocracy. It's a somewhat hypocritical theocracy, in as much as the Saudi royal family use the Wahhabi sect as a way to maintain political control through religious oppression. If you are so besieged and overwhelmed by religious strictures, where women can't even drive in that country, and the religious police are running around making sure you're not showing too much of your, you know, a couple of wisps of hair coming out from under your burqa, then you don't have time for even thinking about anything else, let alone revolution. And presumably, this is a part of the logic of going after this blogger who dared to try to engage some Saudi Arabian citizens in a discussion.
I think that's exactly right. Government in Saudi Arabia is not an elected government. Its legitimacy is highly dubious and highly questionable. We don't know what Saudi people really want because there are no elections. There's not even any polling or surveying. It's just not allowed to conduct public opinion surveys in Saudi Arabia on anything political. And so the government instead relies on alliances with various cliques to maintain its authority and maintain its power. And anyone that should dare to question, even if peacefully, the structure of the government, the absence of democracy, the absence of basic rights and freedoms, the government promptly does what it's doing to Raif Badawi, which is it canes them, it publicly humiliates them, and it jails them.
And one of the charges against Badawi, and by the way, he got his wife and children out before he was sentenced in 2012 when he was arrested. And he was charged, though, with insulting Islam through electronic channels. And this is the one that I find extraordinary. And going beyond the realm of obedience. So that gives you an idea of that, the government structure. It's an absolute medieval monarchy. There's nothing else except all you can do is petition the king and hope for mercy.
That's exactly right. And you know, there are a lot of things that we in the international community can and should be outraged about and can and should change, and I think that this is one of them. We may not be able to affect what ISIS and its supporters believe and do, but we can and should be able to affect what Saudi Arabia does because it has stated itself to be an ally, a military ally, a political ally with the United States and with many, many other countries that are currently engaged in a war against ISIS. They should not be allowed to be part of this coalition when the values that this government espouses are not that different from the values that ISIS espouses, when the practices that this government carries out, like beheading people, lashing people, jailing them because they discuss religion, is not that different from what ISIS does to people under its control.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Whitson, who's Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division, where she oversees 19 countries with staff located in 10 countries. And she has an article at CNN, Saudi Bloggers, Flogging Should Outrage the World. I take it you don't have any staff in Saudi Arabia, right?
No, we don't have any staff permanently based in Saudi Arabia.
And how do you get information out of Saudi Arabia?
Well, we get into Saudi Arabia from time to time. We also have an extensive network of lawyers, human rights activists, journalists, writers, intellectuals, artists, who are the source of a lot of information. I think what people, I hope, will appreciate is that there are brave souls like Raif Badawi who love their country, who love the Saudi people, and want to see their country be a normal country, be one where people can live in freedom and with dignity. And those are the people we are trying to support in Saudi Arabia.
So for an American audience to get an understanding of this kind of medieval theocracy, which benefits, of course, an unaccountable ruling family who are the recipients of the vast oil revenues that pour in every day. And as we know, the Saudi Arabians are now flooding the market to lower the price of oil, and they are able to do it because they have enormous production capacity at low costs. And frankly, Sarah, I have a theory that, you know, most people think that the Saudis are in collusion with the United States to punish the governments that we're unhappy with, which is Russia, Iran, and Venezuela. And we know that Saudi Arabia and Iran are engaged in some kind of a proxy war in the region. But my sense is that what the Saudis are actually doing is that the royal family has figured out that global warming is real and that they've got about 20 years to get rid of all their oil before, or at least get rid of as much as they can before it's essentially outlawed. And they're going to be flooding the market for the longest time. They're already putting the frackers out of business. They're putting Keystone out of business. They're putting the Arctic oil out of business. They're putting Russia out of business. They're hurting Iran. And Venezuela is likely to collapse at any moment. That's my little... I know,
yeah,
it's a digression.
I mean, that may be the case. It's bit me on the focus of my own
exactly,
work.
Exactly. Exactly. But I just was, sorry, I went off on a tangent there. But
that's okay.
But in terms of to understand the nature of this government, which I don't think we can get our heads around, would it be somewhat like if the Americans didn't have an American Revolution and we still had a king and we had King Rick Santorum, the absolute ruler of America?
I think it would be far worse because even if we hadn't had a revolution, we might still have a monarchy that is limited by a parliament, which even the British had during the time of the American Revolution. The reforms that we saw of even absolute monarchies in the 1600s that led to some sort of parliamentary engagement and oversight, even that doesn't exist in Saudi Arabia. There is no elected parliament. The so-called Shura Council that exists, a body appointed by the king, has no power. It has no legislative authority. All it can do is make recommendations, and of course it's an extremely tepid and conservative institution because they operate at the whim and mercy of the king.
But do we know, surely because there are communications there, and I know, you know, if you go to the airport in Riyadh, all of the issues of Time magazine have been, any advertisement showing a beautiful woman has been blacked out, and they have legions of people with black pens doing this stuff. It's extremely low tech. But there's, you know, there's still, my understanding is, because of the internet and et cetera, young Saudis do get information about the rest of the world. Is that your understanding?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. It's just farcical, the government's efforts to be the ostrich and keep its head in the true sand of the Arabian deserts. The country, the population, the youth have moved well beyond the absurd proclamations of its government and the king. In his 80-plus years, has really no connection or insight into what teenagers and youth in their 20s want or live. And these youth are very much a part of the modern world. I have visited Saudi Arabia a number of times and in regular contact with Saudi youth. There is a yawning gap between the government and its Wahhabi religious police and the thrust of the youth in the country, who are very much part of the 21st century.
And presumably they know about the Arab Spring, right?
Oh, absolutely. They know about the Arab Spring, and many were cheering the Arab Spring and suffered sorely for that. They are very connected to the struggles of the Arab people, not just in Palestine, but throughout the region.
So then, I take it, then what's really going on here, the subtext for our conversation is that the Saudi royals and the Wahhabis basically are paranoid and they strike out at any slightest inkling of liberal reform.
That's exactly right. I mean, liberal reform will mean the end of the monarchy as we know it. It will mean the end of the absolute monarchy. It will mean the end of arbitrary rule. It will mean the end of people being killed for sorcery and so forth.
So what are the likelihood then? I mean, when you have that kind of implacable resistance to change, you know, you don't normally have a gentle transition. You normally have a violent one.
Well, I think looking into the future and predicting the future is a bit beyond my pay grade. I can tell you things don't look very good right now. We are in the throes of a massive counter-revolution in the region that has squashed the Arab uprisings everywhere it could reach. Fortunately, Tunisia has managed to escape that regressive tsunami, but sadly, Egypt has not.
Well, but the Egyptian counter-revolution has been financed by the Saudis in large part.
The Egyptian counter-revolution, I would say, is certainly the current military regime ruling in Egypt is, in fact, extremely beholden to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, who are bankrolling, financing the Egyptian government, which would otherwise be in an absolute state of bankruptcy.
So it's pretty clear where they stand. And it's very difficult to understand the level. We know the level of discontent in Saudi Arabia, but how it can be channeled and organized is a huge question. What about
a huge question.
What about, though, the Shiite majority on the Gulf region where all the oil is? That's a restive population, and the Saudis quite often sort of preemptively arrest, even kill people. And the Saudi court just sentenced a Shiite cleric to death for criticizing the government. Again, the sentence was for breaking allegiance with the ruler. So what's going on in the Gulf area where the Shiites, who are considered apostates by the Sunni clerics, is that a restive area?
Well, within Saudi Arabia, there are some provinces like Najran that have a very large population of Shia. Shia make about 10 to 15% of the overall population in Saudi Arabia, and they are subject to wide-scale discrimination. There are no prominent Shia in high governmental roles. They feel that their provinces don't get adequate investment or development. And in fact, you'd be shocked to know that there are parts of Saudi, including the Shia provinces, that poverty is quite prominent in an otherwise such a rich country. In Bahrain, which is the only Shia-majority country in the Gulf, of course, the Saudi government very much supported the king and the king's efforts to quash the democratic uprising in Bahrain, which obviously would have brought justice and representative government to the Shia majority population, who are otherwise an oppressed majority by the Sunni minority.
And is that a part of the confrontation with Iran, Saudi Arabia's paranoia that Iran has some leverage to incite the restive Shia population?
Absolutely, and they routinely accuse Iran of doing just that, not just in Bahrain, but also in Yemen, for example. And of course, it's no secret that the Iranian government has ties with Hezbollah, the Shia minority in Lebanon's political and military wing. And as well in Yemen, where the Houthi minority are alleged to have ties with Iran. So this, you know, wherever there is a Shia community, they are accused of being in collusion with the Iranian government. And you know, as far as we know, there's actually little evidence for many of the allegations that are made in that regard. But, you know, it's just political rhetorical fighting more than anything else.
So, Sarah Whitson, what do you know about Saudi Arabia's lobbying efforts in Washington? You know, a lot is said about the so-called Israel lobby, AIPAC, and their influence over Congress. But the Saudis have enormous amounts of money, and we know our political system's entirely driven by money now since the Citizens United decision. So my sense would be that I bet the Saudis are spending a lot of money and spreading it around Washington.
Well, they absolutely are, and the greatest beneficiaries of this are American PR firms who readily lap up the money thrown at them, not just by Saudi Arabia, not just by Egypt, not just by Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, but of course the primary role model for Washington lobbying, and that's Israel. Sadly, much of American foreign policy is not determined by what's in the best interests of the American people or what's in the best interests of American national security, but really who's the highest bidder, who's got the most lobbyists to woo the most congressmen to steer policy decisions in their direction.
Well, just in closing, I'd like to remind the audience that this Saudi blogger has, because he set up a liberal network online and he sought to encourage debate on religious and political matters in Saudi Arabia in 2008, he in 2012 was sentenced and convicted to punishment of 10 years in prison with 1,000 lashes. He was also fined 1 million Saudi riyals, that's $270,000, and banned from any media work or foreign travel for 10 years after his release. So that's 20 years of purgatory within his own country. And he's already had one set of lashes, 50, and he's due for another 50 lashes on Friday. So I guess we leave our audience on that cheery note, right?
That's right.
Very, very sad, very disgusting. And I hope, and I congratulate you for trying to do something about it, Sarah.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Whitson, who's Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division, where she oversees 19 countries with staff located in 10 countries. She has led dozens of advocacy and investigative missions throughout the region, focusing on issues of armed conflict, accountability, legal reform, migrant workers, and political rights. And she's published widely on human rights issues in the Middle East in international and regional media, including the New York Times, Foreign Policy, the Los Angeles Times, and CNN, where she has an article, Saudi Bloggers Flogging Should Outrage the World. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into whether a second progressive era is emerging.
Yeah. I see my light come shining from the west down to the east. Any day now, any day now, I shall be released.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Glastris, the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, where he wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care and to the budget. Before joining the White House, he spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report, and has an article in the current issue of The Washington Monthly, Why a Second Progressive Era is Emerging and How Not to Blow It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Glastris.
Great to be here.
And I'm sure that this is music to the ears of progressives that are listening to this program. But on the other hand, they didn't show up, or at least the American left, for the want of a better description, didn't show up in the last elections. And the Republicans were able to win by default. And now they control the House and Senate. And you can see from the activity in the House that they are really out of the gate, moving fast. They're changing the definition of how you measure tax cuts impact on the federal budget. They're conducting a war on mathematics. Just in the last couple of days, they have given enormous gifts to Wall Street. And also, they have attacked the very foundation of how government regulations are brought about. And they basically have a very cynical program to gum up the works, to create even more paperwork, to swamp the ability of the government to make regulations and make it easy for corporations to challenge government relations. So that's just a brief sketch of what they're up to. So when are we going to see this counter-revolution coming from the political left in this country?
So, you know, if you go back and you go back 100, 110, 120 years ago, during the sort of the dawn of what we call the progressive era in America, from which progressive take their name, you know, it was a very similar kind of era. You had millions of Americans whose economic prospects were declining, people who whose farms were indebted and weren't able to pay their debts, and were furious at the new technologically driven changes in the marketplace that were ruining them. You had massive movements of people creating a lot of low wage industry jobs that a family could barely keep itself fed on. You had a rising class of technologically savvy professionals who were doing fine themselves, but found themselves alienated from their government that they thought was corrupt and inefficient. And the powers of control over the government, the policy and legal powers of government, were in the hands of a plutocratic class of monopolists who dominated Washington dominated New York, dominated the financial world, dominated the corporate world, and seemed completely insulated from any attempts to reform them. So very, very similar time. Well, what happened? We had this movement that began with the Prairie Populists and then progressed through Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and you know, ultimately led to the New Deal, on and off this progressive era where we tamed the worst aspects of capitalism. We put rules on the economy that allowed individual entrepreneurs and workers to gain traction and upward mobility. We created new government entities that were not subject to the old-style corruption and interest group manipulation, that were filled with the best minds of the generation and did a better job than had been done before of disinterestedly deciding policy issues and running programs. And we had, you know, many years of rising incomes and stability in this country. So I think we are due for another progressive era, but, you know, one has to be cognizant of the differences between that era and this era. And the two differences that, I mean, there are many, many differences, right? And the progressive era was not altogether a great thing. There were all kinds of horrible aspects to it, like, you know, the eugenics movement and so forth. But the two big issues that I think distinguish ours from theirs is, number one, back then both political parties had progressive wings, right? Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican. Herbert Hoover, who we remember as, you know, failing to deal with the Depression, was actually quite a progressive guy, and the Hoover Dam and all, right? And a Republican. And you also had a Democratic progressive wing, too. Woodrow Wilson, Senator La Follette from Wisconsin, and so forth. So you had both parties competing to offer reforms of government that would help ordinary people and tame the power of money and corruption. Today, we really only have that from one party. We have the Democratic Party that has more or less coalesced around a kind of a new progressive, I wouldn't say it's fully fleshed out agenda, but certainly there's a lot of energy focused on money and politics and inequality and the failures of Congress to take actions necessary to allow opportunity to be broad and to bring some sanity to our courts and laws. But on the other hand side, you have a Republican Party that has, you know, at best a tiny rump progressive portion of it, but in general has given itself over to a kind of know-nothing anti-governmentism, which, by the way, existed back certainly in the first part of the 20th century, but didn't dominate the Republican Party the way it dominates now. So that's just difference number one. Difference number two is, back then, progressives thought in terms of how to reform government itself, the bureaucracies of government, the guts of government. And this is where I think the progressives on the left have to be faulted and they have to think through what they're doing a little better. I don't think you can find 1 in 100 progressives who really has a good idea of what reforms really need to be brought to government. You know, how should the bureaucracies be restructured? How should the relationship between Congress and the executive branch be restructured? How do we better have a government that can deal with the onslaught of lobbying? What is the proper relationship between the federal government, states, and local governments? What do we do about federal contracting? All of these issues, which some progressives have some ideas about some pieces of it, but there's really, you know, progressives really keep their eyes on things having to do with social issues, money in politics, you know, just general political battles, programs that they want, you know, early childhood or expanded Social Security. They're really focused on getting programs passed, beating back the Republicans, and so forth. They're not, at this point, focused on reforming the broader government. And back in the progressive era, the best minds of the progressive era were thinking about that. They thought about how to recreate bureaucracies, how to reform our government. So I think if we don't have two changes, one, we need a Republican Party that has a faction, a big enough faction, that is trying, a competitive faction that is devoted to making the government work better rather than tearing the government apart. And we need a democratic progressivism that it doesn't just say it's for government, but understands, in fact, how government works and what we need to do to change it. Unless we get those two things, I don't think that the energy that's out there for a new progressive era, and we see it everywhere. Elizabeth Warren would be a good example, the excitement around her. I mean, there's 100 examples. I don't think that energy is going to lead to a new progressive era unless we get those two changes. So that's kind of what my story is about.
Well, just in the last minute, it would seem to me that there's also a lack of morale and motivation in the sense that conservatives proudly proclaim their conservatism. It got so crazy in the last Republican presidential debates that Mitt Romney said, "I'm a severe conservative." They were all jumping over each other to show how conservative they are. Liberals never stand up and say, "I'm a proud liberal." So don't we have to fix that? And don't we need some people to make a stand apart from Elizabeth Warren?
You know, I do think that the country could use a bigger liberal base, right? There are more self-described conservatives by a long shot than there are self-described liberals. You know, if there were more self-described liberals, liberals would have more power. But most people don't think of themselves as liberals. The Democratic Party is really a much more so. The Democratic Party is a coalition between liberals and moderates, whereas the Republican Party is primarily conservative. Probably 60%, 70% of people who vote in Republican primaries self-identify as conservative, where I don't think it's even 50% of Democrats who vote in Democratic primaries consider themselves liberal. There are just a lot more moderates in the Democratic Party. So for the Democrats to succeed, they have to come up with ideas and policies that excite both moderates and liberals. And, you know, that's not an easy thing. But it's necessary if the progressive side of the equation is ever to take power.
Well, Paul Glasrous, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Glasrous, who's the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, where he wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care and the budget. Before joining the White House, Paul spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News & World Report, and he has an article in the current issue of The Washington Monthly, Why a Second Progressive Era is Emerging and How Not to Blow It. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline reads